Today is Saturday, July 10th, 2021. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jen Hogan. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jen. How are you today?
I'm well, Tom. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. Jen, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You do.
Thank you so much. In part one, you had mentioned an accident you were in that caused some seizures that changed your service status. And this was in 2000 or 2001? Do I have that right?
No, not quite. That accident wasn't until 03.
Okay. So let's start then before that. And I think you were at F.E. Warren. Where is that and what is it and what were you doing there?
F.E. Warren is in Cheyenne, Wyoming. It's a intercontinental ballistic missile base.
Okay.
And that's part of Space Command, which is, the Air Force's main hub for nuclear weapons, essentially.
Okay.
So I started there working out in what we call the missile field. So it's actually very similar to, going down to, the ranger stations in the canyon. We would go out for, a week at a time and come back and be off for a week, that kind of thing. So we would travel really far away to, a quad state area. You just stay out in these restricted areas, essentially. And there's a lot involved, but it basically just involves, driving around in Humvees and, doing exercises and just fun stuff. I enjoyed it. It was a very backcountry-like job.
Would you, set up spike camps at night, or would you be in some quarters at night?
No, we were actually required to be, unless we were, actually on site or on a convoy, we actually had a facility that we had to stay in, and it's a restricted area, and there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go too much into all that stuff.
Right, but I was thinking, were you camping, or were you actually sleeping in a bed at night?
No, yeah, we have quarters.
Oh, okay,
Yeah, and then a lot of times we were out on, out in the field, essentially camping in our, outside with our Humvees and such. So.
Cool. Okay.
That was something we did as well, but it just kind of depends on the mission.
Got it. And you were there for how many years at F.E. Warren?
I was there from 01 until 05.
Okay. All right. And you met somebody during that time, is that right?
I did, yeah. Actually, right after one of our non-commissioned officers actually kind of over me. He worked in operations, and we were friends. And then I had my car accident, and we got to be real good friends after that. It was kind of a cool story. After I was having seizures and such from the accident, and I couldn't drive or do anything. And in the middle of Wyoming in the winter, that's a really unfortunate thing, especially when you live off base. So I was recovering and everything. He gave me a ride to work. in those brutal, brutal Cheyenne winters. And so we got through good friends, did a lot of hiking, stuff like that. And we ended up getting married in 04.
Cool.
And we had my son in 05. And then we left F.E. Warren shortly after that.
What was his name?
Jake.
Okay. And so you married in 04, and you had your son in 05. What's your son's name?
Caleb.
Okay. Caleb.
Who is now turning 16 in September.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. I don't know where the time went.
Yeah, no kidding. So when you left Fort Warren, F.E. Warren, where did you go?
The next few years are kind of a jumble of everything, so it'd be kind of hard to honestly go by piece through all of it. But kind of to summarize from, 05 until we'll just skip up to, 09.
Okay.
Going back a little bit. So when I had my son, which was actually why I got out of the military, so that might be kind of a good piece to cover.
Yeah, please.
They gave us orders simultaneously to Osan and Kunsan in Korea, which is a remote tour, 365 days. Those are both bases on the DMZ, and, it's a remote 365. I could have taken you can take families to Osan, but not Kunsan. I was assigned to Kunsan. My ex-husband was assigned to Osan. My son was very sick when he was born, so, you know, the prospect of taking him to a third world country, you know, prominent with disease like, you know, yellow fever, malaria, things like that, really wasn't doable. So, anyways, my enlistment came up, and I got out, and it was absolutely the right choice. My ex-husband ended up going to Korea. You know, my son got better. I'm not getting into too much of that, but we went back up to Illinois where my dad was and everything for some time, and I was going to school and everything after I got out. I'm just kind of taking care of my son and, you know, getting him where he needed to be.
Cool.
And then kind of fast-forwarding, my ex-husband came back from Korea, and we took an assignment in Mississippi up in Columbus at the pilot training base up there near Tupelo, which is in the northern part of the state. And then we did that for a bit, and then actually I took a job working for the Air Force as a civilian over in the Middle East. And I was over there for the first year by myself, and then I ended up bringing my son over, and then, or my son and my ex-husband, they came over. And then we were over there for quite a long time, actually. We didn't return home from the Middle East until 2012. So we lived over there for about 4 years.
Okay. All right. So there's a lot of desert over there. Did you get a chance to get out in that country at all?
Heck yeah. It was amazing. I loved it. It was awesome.
What did you see? Tell me about it.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, we went all over the place, you know, Oman, Jordan, you know, UAE, Doha, Saudi Arabia. Well, I got to go to Saudi, but it's, you know, kind of a restricted place to go.
I mean, did you get out in the...
We lived out of Kuwait.
Did you get out into the Great Sand Country?
Heck yeah, it was amazing. And it's such a different thing. And it's not what you would necessarily expect. Like, the Middle East in general, like, there's this really, like, you know, Hollywood, you know, I think perception of what it is, and it's really not that way at all.
Right.
You know, you have these huge cities like Dubai and Kuwait City and Doha, you know, Bahrain, all these different places, and these are big functional cities, you know. It's very different than our cities, but still cities all the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, for example, talking about like Kuwait City. We primarily lived in Kuwait, and, you know, we had a villa downtown, which was, you know, because Kuwait's a fairly, I don't want to say safe, but as safe as it goes for the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like down the street, you would have like, you know, a Hard Rock and, you know, malls and things like that. And then you go to like Dubai and you have, you know, the Emirate Mall, and just all this stuff. So there's a ton of money over there, a ton of commerce and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that once you get outside those city limits, it reverts back to being like what you see in the Hollywood movies, which is just Arabian desert.
Hmm.
You know, big, vast sand dunes and camels. And legit, like, you'll be driving around and you'll see, you know, people walking their camels, mm-hmm. you know, just along the highway there. Like, it's like you would see, you know, maybe somebody walking a horse here. So,
yeah,
it's an interesting dynamic over there. But, it's very... It was a fun time. Yeah, we got out quite a bit. Did a lot of, you know, stuff out on the beaches. A lot of beach time when we were there. So.
Okay. Yeah, I think about our deserts here, and the you know, the deserts there. A lot less vegetation in some parts there. And you know, what's that like? I mean, that's vegetation is something we certainly have to deal with here in the Southwest, whether it's cactus or whether it's manzanita, you know, something very thick,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, just, you know, teddy bear choy or things like that. But when I
right.
think
or
of the Middle East.
Or brush, you know, black brush. They don't have that there. I mean, you get out on those dunes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they go as far as the eye can see forever and ever and nothing but just fine sand. You know, even on, like, if you think about the sand dunes in the canyon, you know, like Tanner Beach, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Or even in New Hants, you know, just like a general beach, like. You know, you've got vegetation and such all incorporated in the sand dunes.
Right.
You don't have that there. It's just sand forever and ever and ever. You know, like here we talk about there's no shade. Oh, no. Compared to there, there's an amazing amount of shade everywhere in the Grand Canyon.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you go out in the Arabian Desert, and that's it. That's truly no shade anywhere to be found at all, period. You know, and the temperatures are, I mean, they blow anything we have here out of the water.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you'll have a, on like, so for example, like right now, you know, we're pushing, we've been at 120 several times out of Phantom in the shade, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, ambient, like in the shade in like say Kuwait or, you know, Saudi Arabia, something like that right now would be like, you know, 135, 140. Those are actual temperatures that like you see on the forecast.
Wow.
No, today it's going to be 135. It's like, what? You know, in the shade, like if there was shade, you could find it. Which puts your temps, you know, like say walking in the sun, well over 200 degrees.
That's amazing.
So yeah, it's a pretty interesting dynamic over there.
So when you came back in 2012, unless there's more you'd want to tell about that time, when you came back in 2012, what did you do?
2012, so I came back. I'd been going to school, you know, finishing my bachelor's, and I earned that back in 2009.
Okay.
And I went back to grad school.
What was your BA in? Remind me again.
What's that?
Your bachelor's, what was that in?
Well, I got my first two in criminal justice and psychology, and then I went back a few years back and went and got a degree in geography and cartography.
Okay, cool. And did you get a master's or a PhD, either one of those?
I did. I had two masters. I went back and I did a master of essentially administration, public administration, and then coupled with emergency management.
Okay.
So I'm actually a CEM, which is a certified emergency manager. So I went back and got my certification for that. I ended up not wanting to be confined to a box, as it turns out.
Yeah.
So, that's what CEMs do. I still do a ton of emergency and rescue and such, but I went away from the EM.
So what is a certified emergency manager? I've never heard of that.
Yeah. So the best way that I could characterize it for most to understand, if you think like. Like, you know that movie, I know a lot of us don't watch a lot of TV, but, like, that movie, like, Volcano, Tommy Lee Jones, he's an emergency manager.
Okay.
It's essentially when, like, the guy that's at ground zero orchestrating everything. So it's, like your overall incident commander. So everything comes through them. And you spend a lot of that time, you know, at a truck looking at maps,
mm-hmm.
plotting, and sending people certain places. So it's essentially... you know, the boss in the command center.
Got it.
And I don't want to be in the command center. I want to be out doing stuff.
Right, so. Right. That's the thing. You become a manager, that means there's a desk waiting somewhere.
Right. And it's a really cool job. And, you know, I was really good at it. But I just, you know, like, for example, we do searches here in Canada. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, in the EOC. I want to be out looking for people. You know, that's what I bring to the table. So.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of went away from that.
Yeah.
But,
and
you know,
I think
of... a lot of stuff I learned with that, and then cartography has all been helpful.
I think of the incident command structure, and did your training in the certified emergency manager, I'm assuming that it would have been well-versed in that incident command structure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the backbone of it. And,
okay.
You know, I've been working with FEMA for as long. You know, I do a lot of stuff with them. Most recently, I was at the Virgin Island Response back for Maria and Irma some years back. So I went for that. But yeah, I still do quite a bit with FEMA when I can. And yeah, I enjoy the work. When I was getting my master's, I did my internship in Las Vegas, actually, with the Red Cross.
Oh.
Part of it. And I ended up working for... I left the Red Cross and then went and finished my internship for the city of Las Vegas. So that was cool.
Huh. What? So, well, I guess when I think of Vegas, I don't think about incident command, but I suppose they must.
Yeah. So actually the year I was there, it kicked off with a huge flood. It was the worst that, you know, Vegas had ever had. Yeah.
Hmm.
And while I absolutely abhor the city, I'm not a city girl. Vegas is not my favorite, but
mm-hmm.
I lived outside the city and, you know, I was up on the mountain working with the Forest Service and doing stuff up there primarily. But because, you know, I had to go into the city for my internship, there's that component of it. But it was a great experience. So I got to do some big incidents. You know, I'd already been on quite a few, but it was fun it was really helpful to see it on the civilian side.
Yes.
You know, because I'd been on the military spectrum for so long. So it's a really, lucrative thing. Again, Las Vegas, not my favorite, but Mount Charleston was beautiful. I got to work up there quite a bit. I was up there for that big fire they had, actually.
Okay.
And, so it was super cool. It was super cool time.
And I would think this just makes it very comfortable for you when there is some sort of search and rescue activity that is using the incident command system. You just walk in and all the pieces are in place and you know what needs to be done.
Sure, sure. And, you know, it's such a different thing here at the Canyon even, but, certainly looks great on a resume. Got my foot in the door, so.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'll be honest about it. You know, I look really good on paper. I don't use a lot of the stuff that I have.
It means that when you are exposed to it, you're familiar with it, at least to a certain extent. And that's really helpful.
Yeah, and, you know, even just, you know, rescue here at the Canyon. I've been doing ICS and rescue at Grand Canyon for, going into a decade now. And it's just such a different thing everywhere I go. You know, whether it's military or Vegas or Grand Canyon, ICS, the backbone is always the same, but everywhere functions, you know, somewhat autonomously and different. So it's been interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So kind of moving the timeline, you know, along. Got your degrees, and then after your internship, where did you go from there? This is roughly 2012-ish?
Yeah, so I took I had taken a job up in Alaska, actually with the Air Force, working again as a civilian, and I wanted to come to Grand Canyon. I had applied for a job here, and for anyone who's, ever dealt with the NPS or federal government, it's notoriously hard to get your foot in the door with the Park Service, and especially coming from another entity. So I actually just applied for, just a simple admin job just to get my foot. I wanted to come to Grand Canyon. So I put in for the job, way overqualified for it. I didn't think I'd get it. And, that's kind of the irony of applying for jobs. It's like when you're too qualified, they don't want you for that either.
Hey, Jen.
Sometimes you feel like you can't win, but
Hey, Jen. Hang on a second. Right here, I want to ask you because there's something called status.
Yeah.
And did you already have government status at this time, or was that something that was going to come to you at Grand Canyon?
No, I already had it.
Okay, great. So that's not an issue for you. You're just looking for any job at Grand Canyon.
Right, I just wanted to be at the Canyon.
Got it. Neat. And so let's back up a little bit. What attracted you to Grand Canyon? Why did you want to be there?
Oh, I've been in love with this place since I was a kid. I mean, I think I mentioned last, I'm from Arizona. I've always loved canyons and the desert. And, this is my home. So I wanted to come back to Arizona. I didn't necessarily want to be down in Tucson. I do love Tucson, but, I don't know. Yeah, there's some other components to that, but I kind of wanted to be up here by the canyon somewhere, at least close where I could get to it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'll just go for the gold,
Okay.
I saw that job pop open. I was definitely interested in
cool.
Exploring the canyon more and getting into that. And
so they would have offered you the job, but you were already set up for Alaska. Then what happened?
Oh, that was a no-brainer. I called Alaska, and I was like, yeah, well, maybe not going to make it this time. And they were like, okay, so no big deal.
Oh, cool.
And I took a job at the Canyon. Yeah, that was a no-brainer for me. Like, this is where I want to go. So,
what was the job?
Great, but
yeah.
What's that?
What was the job at Grand Canyon that you got, your first job there?
It was actually just as an admin assistant, just doing office stuff.
Okay.
For one of the divisions.
Right.
Not a big deal, but I allowed me to live here and, get free permits and do all that and, sort of exploring the canyon. I got back, I got in search and rescue and doing all that stuff. And,
okay.
And yeah,
was that 2012? What year was that?
Yeah, that was late 2012.
Okay. And I'm assuming that your housing may have changed through the years. What was your housing like when you first showed up at Grand Canyon?
Well, it was great. As a permanent employee, our housing is a little bit different, than some of the seasonal folks.
Right.
It just varies depending on how long you're going to be here. But We actually initially moved into the Paiute apartments.
Okay.
Here in our village, really nice apartments, like
yeah.
brand new.
Yeah.
I don't even know how many times I've moved since, but, you know, I tend to be a little nomadic, I think, and restless. So I tend to think I need to move every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Each time I get a little more simple with it, and now I'm down to like an efficiency little place with basically like a studio that doesn't, you know, I'm not home a lot. I'm in the canyon all the time, so I just like don't have time for all that. But
yeah
I've kind of gone over the last, you know, 10 years or so, and
cool.
I love where I'm at now. It's great. But yeah, the accommodations are amazing. Really affordable, you know, considering I'm literally 5 minutes from my house and looking at the edge of the Grand Canyon. So
yeah, cool. So where did you transfer to from your job as an admin assistant?
Over to backcountry. So I did that for quite a while, waiting for a spot to open up over here. And then, you know, when it did, I popped over.
So is the backcountry office within, is it, it's, and I again, I'm not real clear on the different kind of departments of the park. I think of interpretation and I think of backcountry as a branch of interpretation. Is that right? Or is it its own standalone?
No, it's actually a branch of like Canyon District. So
okay.
We're basically backcountry. We're the same as like Canyon Rangers, except we don't have guns.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we do more like backcountry instead of like, you know, the corridor stations. And so do they, but, you know, they're primarily assigned to, you know, Indian Garden, Phantom, Cottonwood. We help out down there, but, you know, our big thing is, you know, backcountry patrols and then, you know, the backcountry office, we rotate in and out and then, you know, rescue and stuff. So.
Okay. And when did you transfer to backcountry?
What is this, 2021?
So this would be 2012, late 2012 as an admin assistant.
Yeah, I think 2017.
Okay. So let's, there's a big chunk of time here between winter of 2012 and to the backcountry office in 2017. I'm assuming now that you're living at Grand Canyon, you started doing some hiking out there.
Oh, yeah. I've been, like, balls to the wall with us since I got here. So that was, like, and, you know, I had a good schedule for it. I had 410s, which was, you know, awesome. So it was easy for me to do a ton of rescue and a ton of backpacking. So, yeah, I've just, you know, the only difference with this job is just, you know, now I get paid to hike instead of
exactly. Yeah. Can you tell me about, I don't know, a couple of things you remember about that time between 2012 and 2017 when you did move to the backcountry office, when you're an admin assistant, but you're doing search and rescue and you're hiking.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that time?
Well, I mean, I didn't like the work, you know, the admin part of it. That's not really my thing, but, you know, it got me here.
Uh-huh.
And that was the end goal. So,
right.
You know, I was also a little more limited. My son was younger then, so I was, you know, taking care of my son. I was divorced and everything. So I got divorced back in 13, I guess. And, you know, actually, now I'm thinking about it. No, we moved here in 13. Sorry, my dates are, I have a hard time keeping track of the years. Yeah, we moved here in 13 because I got divorced in 13. So,
okay.
Yeah, we moved here in 13. Yeah, that's right. We came back from Kuwait in 12. We were there for 12 and then moved here at 13. That makes sense. Sorry. Have a hard time keeping track.
No worries. I'm just trying to follow the timeline here. So Caleb would have been 8.
Sometimes I can't keep track of my own timeline. Like, my life has been really, really a lot of everything.
Understood. Without looking at the timeline. So did Caleb then go to the Grand Canyon school?
He did, yeah.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, and then my ex-husband went over to, he was over in Baghdad working as a, military contractor over there doing, you know, various things over there.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get too much into that. He was a military dog handler, so we were both police officers, but he was also, he had a dog. So when he got out, he kept on with that. Ended up over there with the State Department and things like that over in Baghdad and this area. So he stayed over there till about 2018. Yeah, that sounds right. 2017, maybe.
Okay.
Don't you know? Don't hold
roughly
me to years, but
yeah,
it's around that time frame.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, part of our agreement was that, when, you know, when he came back, you know, my son would primarily live with him and, you know, basically just kind of pass the baton. And it was fair. He's a wonderful human.
Mm-hmm.
He's still a dear friend of mine. We're still a family, just a different kind.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's getting the best of both his parents. So Caleb now spends the summers with me and, you know, we rotate holidays and everything. But it's great. And, you know, he's got the best of both his parents and it's been awesome. So there's that.
Cool.
But yeah, so Caleb primarily now lives in Mississippi and I'm here in the Canyon. But he's like here with me now through September and then he'll go back.
Cool. Okay.
And then come back for Christmas and so forth. But anyways, yeah, my son's a big hiker. So that time, you know, I just literally hit the ground running. And, you know, one thing I was always big for me. I mean, I never, I just always took my son with me. So from the time he was like 3, you know, I started hiking with him. And, you know, he's a big canyon hiker. He knows it very well. You know, he's been hiking the trails here since he was 7.
Cool.
So yeah, he's a big backpacker, big pack raster now. Just got into that.
Oh, sweet.
I wanted him to be big enough that he could, you know, get himself in, and you know, that he could safely negotiate the whitewater. But
yeah,
I love the pack rafting. He's killing it. So doing good.
Hey, what tips do you have for parents that have small children in the 3 to 7 or 8 or 10 year old range, for heading outside? For camping.
Actually,
and hiking.
I'm stoked that you asked me that question because that's always such a passionate thing for me. I see a lot of parents, you know, women in particular, that use kids as a reason not to go do stuff.
Mm.
And I think it's quite the contrary. Take them with you.
Yes.
You know, and to caveat on that, don't tell them what their limitations are. That's one thing I never did with my son. You show me what you can and can't do. You know
cool.
what I mean?
Yeah.
What you're comfortable with.
Okay.
In terms of kids, and I actually, one thing I would really love actually to hit on, because it was a big lesson learned for me as a parent, getting my son in the backcountry and so forth. And I would even lead with this, and it's just that don't push them too hard.
Okay.
I did. I pushed my son way too hard. And I meant well. I had good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
But I pushed him too hard. And then there came a day where he didn't want to do it anymore.
Okay.
And, you know, he came back to it. I just backed completely off. And it was like, and when I say push too hard, I mean, I'm kind of another level of extreme when it comes to this stuff. And I think I felt like, I just assumed, I think, that he wanted to just do nothing but the canyon all the time.
Because that's what mom wanted to do.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is the best place for him. We're going to be down here.
Yeah.
You know, and at the end of the day, you know, he's a kid, and he wants to play with his friends, too, and he wants to do other things, too. So that would be a big message I have for all parents.
Okay.
Don't push too hard. You know, push enough, but not to the point where they hate it.
Mm-hmm.
I did.
Yeah.
And I regret it. I meant well, but I regret it. And the way that what I would have done differently as it's just like, okay, so we go out for a backpack trip, come back. You know, if he wants to maybe the next weekend hang out, play with his friends, great, don't push him to go back in the canyon. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
That's where I went wrong.
Okay.
And he's come full circle back to it, and we're good to go. And now, like, for example, this summer, we paddle one weekend, you know, like Lee's Ferry or wherever. We do a ton of, you know, paddle boarding and kayaking. We paddle one, and we do backpacking next weekend. So we just got back from a paddle trip. We backpack, and on the next days off, we go backpacking.
Cool.
So that was kind of the balance I found. And, you know, if he wants a weekend off to hang out at the room, we do that too.
Yeah.
That was kind of my lesson learned. But in terms of, like, having little people and backpacking, it's challenging in a lot of aspects. One of the main ones is that you're carrying everything because they can only carry so much with their little bodies, right? And I think that, you know, one mistake parents, I think, make is just, you know, thinking that they're going to need all these things. And that's everybody. You know, we see that here a lot with all the visitors. You know, they think they need so much stuff. And at the end of the day, when you go to camp, particularly in the canyon or in the actual backcountry, you really need very little. You know, your kids are busy, you know, swirling around in the creek water or, you know, whatever they're doing. They don't need all the stuff that you brought them.
Right.
You know, and they don't need a ton of food. They don't need all this crazy stuff that we think they need. So I think as parents, it's like just really keep it minimal.
Okay.
You know, in terms of what you tell them that they need, you know, like if you bring this, kids will make it work, right? Like, so like, okay, you know, we have these things. Here's camp. We're going to enjoy nature. Great. Yeah, but I don't know. I know I'm jumping around, but I think just take them with you. You know, give them the opportunity to push the limits and, you know.
Nice.
Get them out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Cool.
Safely, of course.
Yes.
But, you know. That's where it's really good to, you know before you go, plan ahead, ask questions, talk to rangers, things like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I think that, you know, and I think actually backpacking with your kids makes you a stronger, you know, backpacker or hiker or whatever it is.
How
you're
so?
Doing, just because, well, you really have to fine-tune your skills to be able to do it, not just for you, but for them.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So, like, for example, like, packing to go backpacking with me and my son. Okay, I'm not just packing my pack, which is hard for most people, you know, just to get yourself ready to go in the backcountry. Having to do for two people, because now you have to remember two sets of everything, or what things can we both share, do you know what I mean? It's a whole other level of fine-tuning, and you really figure out quickly how to be efficient at it, which I think really helps you be better. And even coming down to, like, water. So say you're going in an area with limited water. Man, like, you don't want to haul 3 gallons of water, right? So you're going to get efficient with it really, really fast.
Okay.
And, you know, it just really, I think, helps you, I guess, be more, like, situationally aware because you are doing it for two, you know, and not just for the enjoyment and safety factor, but just for the efficiency factor. It can turn into a circus pretty quickly, you know, with kids if you're not careful. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, we certainly had bad trips, but I feel like I got pretty good at it, just being super efficient with it, you know. Does that make sense?
It does, and of course, you were really fortunate to be there at the canyon.
Absolutely.
And of course, you know, other parents, you know, are fortunate to be, well, everybody's, you know, we are where we are geographically.
Right.
And you know, just going camping in your own hometown or, you know, in the country around your hometown. That can be done.
To that end, Tom, you can even, I'll even take it a step further. Like, let's take the folks who are maybe say limited on money,
mm-hmm.
or resources, and they really can't even get outside their house.
Yep.
Okay. Great. Do you have a backyard?
Yeah.
Awesome. Set a tent up back there. Take the time to do it. It doesn't have to be some grand adventure, forgive the pun,
mm-hmm.
but, like, it can just be in your backyard.
Cool.
Going over skills, teaching them and yourself how to do these skills and be efficient. You know, hang out under the stars. It doesn't have to be, because at the end of the day, whether or not you're in the Grand Canyon or Alaska or your backyard,
mm-hmm.
it's that time with your kid. I tell you, I wouldn't trade all the time I've had in the backcountry with my son for anything on this planet.
Mm.
I know him better than I ever would have otherwise, just for that reason. We've had so much time to sit there and lay under the stars and have nothing to do but talk to each other.
Cool.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And my favorite thing now, like, you know, now, especially now he's older and he knows more about everything than I do,
mm-hmm.
like, we lay there and look at the stars and he tells me all about the astronomy stuff. I mean, he's super into astronomy.
Cool.
He tells me all about it. And we sit there and watch the stars. And, you know, like, we have a game every night. You know, we like to count all the shooting stars, see how many we get every night. And, you know, we compile the average and do this whole thing. It's really fun.
Cool.
And I wouldn't trade a lot of stuff for the world. But my point being, you don't have to be in the Grand Canyon or anywhere, you know, geographically just offbeat to do that. You can do it in your backyard, right?
Yeah.
So I guess that would be probably actually the biggest message to parents is, like, don't get sucked into that, you know, routine, into that mindset where it's like, oh, I'm tired, I don't feel like setting up the tent. Take the time to do it. Go set that thing up. You know, we're cowboy camping. We do a ton of cowboy camping.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's amazing, you know, and that too is where you push the limits. I mean, my son had a rattlesnake crawl over him the other night, and he's still cowboy camping, you know, like, that was something he had to, like, accept and cope with, and
mm-hmm.
you know, he's still okay with it, so that was, like, a really good you know, exercise for him. But again, you can do that in the backyard.
Yeah.
State parks, I mean, there's anywhere you're at, there's somewhere you can go to set up a tent with your kid.
Yes,
know?
Yeah, cool. All right, very good. So you got to Grand Canyon roughly 2013 ish. When did you start becoming aware of the concept of hiking the length of Grand Canyon from Lee's Ferry to the Grand Wash Cliffs in the far western, Lee's Ferry in the far eastern edge of the park, all the way across the park to the far western edge of the park at the Grand Wash Cliffs? When did that first get onto your radar screen? Do you remember?
Yeah, I read Colin Fletcher's book.
Okay. When was that?
And, oh gosh, that was like back in, 13, it was right when I got here.
Okay.
When I moved here. And I got a hold of that book, and somebody recommended to me. I was getting out doing all this crazy stuff. And
okay.
Like, hey, have you read? And I was like, no, I haven't. And I read it, and I was like, okay, I'm doing that. And then, you know, it just kind of went from there. Kind of that's where, like, the true obsession sort of began. I just spent the next, from then until, you know, ongoing now, just completely obsessed with it. And I still am. I mean, I did it, and I'm still obsessed with it. That's all I think about all the time.
Right, and I want to do a whole interview with you on that event, but I just want to make sure that we don't miss anything before we get there.
Right, Tom's like, all right, slow down. Don't get too excited.
No, we'll get there. I'm still trying to envision you as an administrative assistant with an office, right? Okay, I'm trying to envision this. Like, just how did that happen? I don't know. Well, there you are.
It was rough. It was a little rough, but it was a sacrifice I had to make to be here. So,
yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, these backcountry jobs aren't easy to just walk into. You know, people
right.
tend to get into them and they don't leave. So,
yeah.
A lot of times you just gotta wait until someone leaves, and that's what happened with me. Someone left, and I got my foot in.
Okay, and had you been like volunteering over there, or applying, or trying to, you know, kind of stay around the backcountry shop? I'm thinking of. Mark...
Not really. I just kind of got my name out there. You know, I doing a ton of rescue and stuff with Canyon District. I'm volunteering with them and with PSR and all that. So,
okay.
It was a pretty easy transition. When I applied, I got it. In fact, they asked me to apply. So, it was a no-brainer. But then,
cool.
Again, I put my time in. You know, I did the work. I volunteered. I got my name out there, and I worked really hard. So,
and I'm also thinking about the skills that you have in law enforcement. Why did you make the decision to go into the backcountry office versus the Canyon District as a law enforcement ranger?
I actually just didn't want to be a police officer anymore.
Okay.
I don't know. I feel like you spend so much time seeing the worst side of people.
You do, and it's a responsibility to carry deadly force. Is a huge responsibility for anybody to bear. So.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I loved being a cop, but I don't know. They're just I'm more of a live in peace type, I suppose, these days.
That was then, and this is now, and so yeah. But I just kind of wanted it there because there was a clear break point there of
clear
going
path there, yeah.
Going here or going
no,
there.
I get that question a lot. People are like, why didn't you go get a gun? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I just didn't want to.
Well, no, I mean, it's not a matter of getting a gun. You already had a gun, like you say. You're well versed in all aspects of what it means to be in law enforcement. And yet you walked away from that career to be in the backcountry dealing with the public in a way that law enforcement really doesn't have to. Law enforcement is not, I think of backcountry office people as way into interpretation because they have to educate people day in and day out about,
absolutely,
you know, about how the place works, which is really tough.
We work really closely with the LE and the Canyon, you know, with Canyon LE, and I feel like we have a really good marriage. It's very hand in hand, very, you know, it really works quite well. So it's good.
Cool.
It's really a good relationship that we have. So yeah, I love it. I mean, it's great. And no complaints here.
Okay. Cool. Looking at the time here, we've been going about 40 minutes. We're kind of at a break point here because my next question for you is about the walking the length of the canyon, which you spent, you know, quite a while.
I'm excited to talk about. I'm like, enough
yeah.
all this.
Yeah,
I've
been
stuff,
waiting,
man.
Waiting just to get to
canyon.
Here. But once we kind of get going, because I know eventually, you know, another 10 minutes or so, I'm going to be like wanting to disconnect, and then we'll come back and do it again. I tell you what, Can you tell me about some of your canyon hikes, before through hiking? Meaning, just when you think about hiking in the canyon, what were some of the really cool hikes that you did,
Actually,
apart from the through hiking?
let me jump on that. So, people ask me all the time how I got into all this stuff, and I can actually, it's kind of a fun story. So I started out doing, I've been ultramarathoning for many, many years and marathon doing all this crazy endurance stuff, even before I came here. That was always my big thing. I was a very, competitive runner. And anyway, so I come to the canyon, I'm doing all this crazy stuff. I'm doing like, I'm backpacking, but I've also got my son, so it's a little bit, I can't, it's quite do some of the crazy stuff with him just yet at that point because he was still pretty little. But keep in mind, he's like 8 years old doing like old hands, so yeah, he could get out there, but some of the crazier stuff, that came later for him.
Okay,
But I was doing a lot of these big loops and stuff, right?
hang on.
And so everybody's like,
Hang on.
have you,
So you and I know old hands. The people listening to this recording might not. Can you like give me a little bit of a
gotcha.
sense of what the old Hans is?
I will actually. In
Cool.
fact, we just did it again the other day.
Cool.
The old Hans is kind of a neat thing if you come here to the canyon. The new Hans Trail is the well-known trail that hikers take. It goes down to the Colorado via Red Canyon, which is on the eastern side of the South Rim, between Grandview and Lippitt Point, which is on the desert view, the East Rim Drive, if you will. So it's about a give or take 7 mile trail. Pretty hardy. It's actually the second most difficult rated trail in the canyon. Trail, name trail. I don't mean off trail, all that, but I mean actual name trail. And it's behind Nakeweap. So the basis for that is just that Hans was, John Hans's trail. John Hans was a miner here way back in the day. And he, before he came up with that lovely, well-beaten now New Hans Trail, he had a trail on the in the next canyon over, which is old as the old Hans Trail, the old Hans route. This trail leaves, it's not a trail route anymore, it's not much of anything, but it leaves off the rim just in the middle of the forest, really actually right off the highway there, and it goes down to the east of Sinking Ship, which is a formation there on the rim, real popular one. But anyways, it's a hardy, about a mile straight down, essentially, like kind of 4 point down this thing. It's just a whole lot of everything. Like you look at it, it's kind of a dangerous thing in so many aspects. But like when you, I remember the first time I did it with my son. Like you look at the base of it, you come up and you go, "Man, we're almost out. It's like right there." And then like 8 hours later, as you're four pointing up through the forest, yeah, it's a lot of everything. But essentially, John Hans essentially built this trail, for his mining prospects, and actually more for, it was starting to yield the tourism at that point. But he built and it kept washing out, so that was why he moved it over to New Hans, Red Canyon, which, is a lot, been a lot, obviously a lot more stable. So yeah, it's
When
just this crazy off route that nobody does. It's one of those forgotten old trails on, much like the old Tanner Trail, just an old forgotten and the old Grandview Trail. All trails have just been, kind of relocated and sort of forgotten. And the only people that really maintain them anymore are people like me and, the sheep. That's pretty much it. So yeah.
Yeah, I seem to remember that in my visions of the old Hans, it's a ravine, a steep ravine, and Hans
Yeah, it's
had
an insanely steep ravine, and yeah.
Switchback after switchback after switchback, just these short little back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, but that's all gone now. And so you're sort of, free falling down this ski slope kind of ravine that's full of boulders, and a lot of them are loose, and it's an interesting place.
It is an interesting place, and it's funny, and over the years I've found so many much a lot better ways to go up next to Old Hans, the actual Old Hans chalk stone. So it comes up this little ravine that has essentially four chalk stones, like little chutes, if you will. That's the best way I could describe it as a chute. They're to the east of Sinking Ship. And every one of those chutes, I found better routes that were so much better than Hans's actual route that he had in that ravine. Some of the trail is still there. You can find little stretches of it, but it just gives out where it's just completely washed out. So It's not hard when you get out there on the actual former trail to see why he had to move it. Like, it's just like, oh, we're going along good, and now there's nothing. Okay, and then you're going back. It's a hardy route. It goes down into the Hans Creek drainage proper, which is another popular backpacking spot for more threshold hikes. But Hans Creek, he would take, you know, the clients and stuff down there, and, you know, eventually they came down the Grandview Trail, which is a whole other thing, but that's the next canyon over from that. But there's lots of really cool history and stuff down there, and then from there, you know, you can go off to Horseshoe Mesa or New Hans, which, you know, Red Canyon, Hans Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
You can go down to Sock Dodger, which is the rapid down there at the bottom of Hans Creek, which is pretty awesome. So, and we know you're obviously familiar with Sock Dodger. It's an amazing rapid.
Well, so we'll tie this back. So you're doing ultra marathoning, and you're starting to do some backpacking with your son, like the old Hans. What kind of other, and again, these would be things, you're working four tens. That means you have 3 days off. So you're really kind of tied to a sort of a 3-day adventure, unless you've got a holiday or an actual vacation time.
Yeah, and actually, you know, there was always a lot of it, which I still do. You know, if I've only got, say, 3 days proper, I mean, we would leave the night before and then hike out early the fifth morning.
Okay.
So I had a way of turning it into a 5-day trip.
Cool. Okay.
I mean, it takes sacrifice, absolutely, but, you know, that's what it takes to, if you don't have necessarily the ideal schedule and you still want to do these things, you know, it takes some sacrifice. So, yeah, we made it work. Every week we were out there doing something.
Okay. All right. What other interesting hikes do you remember?
Oh, gosh. But, yeah, actually going back to how I kind of got into backcountry. So,
yeah,
I was doing all this stuff, and, you know, everybody's asking me, have you done this, done that? I'm like, yeah, I'm still just kind of getting into it. You know, this is all my first year here. And they had, you know, some folks had recommended that I go talk to a couple of our, you know, big off-trail rangers, which I did, Todd Saliba and Matt Jenkins.
Okay.
So I go talk to them, and I vividly remember I hiked down Indian Garden to talk to Matt Jenkins, you know, just to pick his brain. And he gives me a list of books, and he's like, work your way through those in this order, and then come back and talk to me.
Okay, so hang on. Todd Seliga, Seliga, I think is how he spells his last name. Now, Todd is stationed out at Toroweep, Tuweep, way out in Western Grand Canyon.
He and Matt are both actually through hikers.
Yes. And he was someone that, so are the two people that you were recommended to talk to, one was Todd and the other was Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. So Matt recommends some books. What books did he recommend for you?
Well, those who hike Canyon could probably guess before I even say it, but, in that order, or in this order, you know, Harvey Butchert and then Steck, George Steck.
Right.
So Harvey Butchert is, you know, one of our fathers of Grand Canyon hiking, and, you know, Matt is just like, work your way through that one, and then when you're ready, you know, when you get through that and you feel confident, you start on the Steck loops. So I did.
So
page by page.
Was Matt saying, don't just read these, but hike these, work your way through hiking them?
Yeah.
Cool. Great.
He's like, read, research, get out there, do what you can, you know, whatever. Let me know if you have questions. But I took that as challenge accepted. So, you know, I took Harvey's book, and I mean, I still will print, you know, copy pages and take it with me. I constantly am reading through it because his notes are so cryptic and in-depth. It sometimes just still boggles the mind, some of the stuff that you're like, what did he mean by that? Did he mean that it was the West Drainage, or did he mean this? So, you know, I'm just completely, I'd spend so much time. So anyways, page by page, yeah, I just check. I mean, I saw my original book, or my one copy that I don't ever take out anywhere, because I've, you know, kept my notes and checked it off. But I worked my way through Harvey's book, with the exception of, like, two that he had on there at the time, which were, like, Quartermaster and, I think, Mohawk. Those were, like, maybe one other, but those were the only ones I didn't have bagged before I moved on to Steck loops.
It's funny, when I think about Butchert's loops book, or Trek's book, sorry. He was a math professor.
Mm-hmm.
And math professors give you the theorem, well, this is how it works, you know, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, the square root of, or whatever the theorem is, now go apply it and do it. It's almost like Harvey wrote saying, well, you know how to backpack, and this route goes, go do it. But he wouldn't give you everything like a typical mathematician with a mathematical problem.
Right. George Stack did that. George Stack was a true math guy, like, and you know that, like, looking at his books, I mean, he tells you the exact approximate time or the exact precise time for here to here, and you'll need this much time for this and this much time for that, and you'll need, you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
It's interesting because they were both math guys and completely opposite on how they articulated Kanten and Huygens.
That's a very good observation. That's right. That's right.
Super fascinating. But yeah, so I got into Stack loops.
Okay.
Worked my way through those. And it's funny because when I got through all that, I realized that once I'd gotten through all that, I didn't need to go talk to Matt anymore.
You know
what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that was what I needed to, you know, and all that time, I'm, you know, just more and more obsessed with the thru-hike, more and more obsessed, more and more obsessed. And, you know, there came a point where I wasn't doing Stack loops anymore. I was doing Huygens loops. So,
cool.
You know, it's just, it kind of, that's really how it started, though, and I can definitely credit Matt for that. He just, and I love that Matt didn't just give it to me. He was like, start here.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was like, and I do that now with people. I'm like, because I want to see it. Are you actually interested in this?
Right.
Or are you going to waste my time? I'm going to sit here and talk to you for 3 hours, and then, you know, you're, you know, whatever. It's like, go out there and find it. You know, they did. Look at Harvey. I mean, he went out there. He didn't have any information.
And he was weekend after weekend after weekend, year after year after year. Yeah.
And that actually is me. That is. This is all I have done for almost a decade, Tom.
Got it.
Days on, days off. I don't go to Flagstaff unless I'm forced. I don't go to other parks. I don't go on vacation. I go to the movies. I don't, you know, any of that. Canyon.
Sweet.
And if I'm not in the canyon, I'm mad I'm not in the canyon. Like, I've just even kind of resigned even trying to do other stuff because all I think about is Grand Canyon.
Cool. Very cool. What did you get from Todd Seliga? So if Matt gave you a Butcher and Steck, what did Todd give you?
Yeah, you know, Todd is a whole other spectrum as well. I don't really know how I would describe Todd. I don't know. I don't even know how to touch Todd Seliga. I really don't. I'm not honestly sure that he's totally human. He may not be. He's just on such a whole other level of just, like, thought than the rest of us, or even just physical ability. And I include myself in that. Like, Todd is just he's just completely amazing. Todd can be really cryptic. He's great information.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you come to Todd with, like, a route, and, like, if I come to him, like, hey, man, here's what I'm thinking. Like, what do you think about this? Like, he'll definitely provide input, but he's very, he'll be very general unless you come to him with a specific question. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, when
Todd's
I...
Todd's amazing. I love Todd. I go to Todd with stuff quite a lot.
When I think of Seliga, I think of somebody who's a vegan, and yet, you know, he will travel tens, if not more, miles a day on foot,
mm-hmm.
All day long. But then maybe he'll transition to a motorcycle or transition to a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
He'll do 100-mile patrols. Think nothing of it. Is friendly. Some might say charming. Personable.
Very much so.
And just a wonderful human being. That's when I think of Todd. That's what I think of.
And actually, Todd kind of, he's the one that kind of gave me the cue to how to, you know, kind of solve that navigational problem. So I do a lot of that myself, like dropping bikes off here and leaving a boat there and then picking it up later and coming back around, looping, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, cool.
Down this trail, come out here, cross there, go back here, still get back over here, and then, you know what I mean? So that was, I took that cue kind of from him, and I do quite a bit of that myself.
Very cool. Okay.
So.
Great, because I was thinking you were going to get something from Matt, you're going to get something from Seliga.
And that
makes sense. Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, that was a big thing I got from Todd. You know, he's just been such a phenomenal, you know, resource.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. You know, not just them. You know, in the last like 5-6 years even. I mean, Rich Rudeau has been an amazing mentor. You know, Ned Bryant is, you know, obviously amazing. I've learned a ton from Ned. And I love the dynamic I get from Ned and Rich.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're both, you know, Rich is more of like a slut, crazy, you know. Rich would rather like spider monkey up something. Ned would rather like bushwhack and hike it, right?
Right.
So I
get
a really fun like middle between those two. So like depending on what I'm looking at or looking for, I go to Ned for some stuff, and then some stuff I go to Rich.
Cool.
You know, or like if I go to Rich and I get a climber answer and I want a hiker answer, I go to Ned. So, you know, just as Matt and Todd have been amazing like resources, like Ned and Richard, though, especially, you know, as I've gotten really, you know, into the through hiking reality,
mm-hmm.
you know, even like 5 years ago, those two have been really phenomenal.
Cool. And, you know, you've mentioned a bunch of males here. Are there any females that you go to and ask for canyon advice?
Absolutely.
Who are they?
So, I'm glad you asked that. I think that, you know, the premier one, I got to give that credit to Deli Yurchik.
Great.
You know, she's a canyon LE, and I started out just kind of running around after her years ago. You know, she'd show me just this and that. Hey, you want to do this patrol? Great. You know, my first trip around the Wahala I did with Della, and I just learned so much from her, and she's amazing in the backcountry. I mean, she's an absolute beast.
How do you spell Della's last name?
Yurchik, Y-U-R-C-I-K.
Thank you. And then you mentioned L-E, that stands for law enforcement, just for
sure.
The transcribers in the world.
Who
are these people? Wait, the Wahala, what?
Wahala Plateau, sorry.
So Della, tell me what you got from Della.
Oh my gosh, what don't I get from Della? I mean, first and foremost, I mean, she's definitely taught me how to be a park ranger.
Okay.
And a good one.
Cool.
You know, how to treat people, you know, the way that you want to be treated and how they should be treated, how to protect the park at the same time. And that's
nice.
A hard balance to find.
Yeah.
So definitely get that from her compassion, unbelievable, endless levels of compassion. She's got to be probably the kindest, most just biggest hearted person I've ever met in my life.
Nice.
And I will tell you, like, in terms of backcountry, she has got some skills, like good luck keeping up, and I'm fast.
Mm.
So I mean, best way I can describe it. I mean, I feel like I spent so many years just chasing after her, you know?
Nice.
And just teaching me. One thing I love about Della is that she's always open to new ideas and learning, you know, like, you know, there's no ego involved. There's no any of that. It's just like, oh yeah, you know, actually my way might be dumb. Let's try it this way, you know, or hey, actually, have you thought about doing it this way?
Hmm.
She's just really a great person to, you know, to show you the backcountry. So
cool.
Yeah, I've learned just an amazing amount from her, and she's fantastic. And I still hike with her quite a bit. She's a very dear friend of mine. So
good.
In terms of like females for Grand Canyon, it's hands down Della.
Cool. Okay. Anyone else? Any other females that come to mind?
You know, I'm thinking from a true backcountry perspective, I think Della. Yeah.
Okay. I was, and I'm really sorry because I'm spacing on her name right now. But Matt's partner.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Let me dial back. Alyssa, absolutely.
Thank you.
Sorry.
What's Alyssa's last name?
Shala.
And how do you spell that?
Shalla.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Alyssa was less, like, backcountry for me, but she was, you know, the Indian Garden Ranger for a long time. She's now the North Rim District Ranger for Interpretation.
Okay.
But her and her husband, Matt, through hiked the canyon together, you know, some years back, I think 16 maybe, or 18 or one.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a big inspiration for me, you know, with my own aspirations.
Cool.
You know, Alyssa, she didn't solo it, but, man, what an awesome, awesome thing. And the crazy thing about Alyssa, she'd actually, at that point, when she thru-hiked it with Matt, had only, you know, reference for the viewer or for anyone listening to this, like, Matt Jenkins is the guy I referenced with Todd Seliger. That's her husband.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, up until the point they decided to thru-hike it, and really the whole idea was just them to be able to spend some time together, but she'd only spend like a handful of nights in the backcountry,
wow.
like outside of Indian Garden.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah. So, I mean, granted, she had Matt Jenkins with her, but still, I mean, that's amazing to go from that to walking through. Because at the end of the day, you still got to do the walking and the not dying and the, you know what I mean?
Right.
All that stuff. So,
you got to walk it. You got to protect your
yeah.
feet. You got to make it happen.
Yeah, and Alyssa and Della, and I apologize to Alyssa about, like, I didn't mean to leave her off. But, yeah, she's been phenomenal as well. Her and Della both have always been super supportive of my through hiking stuff.
Cool.
To include when I got hurt, and I know we'll get into that later. But
yeah.
So both of them were both huge rocks for me.
Sweet.
Really big. So.
Sweet. Great. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that perspective there, because I think it's real important. Okay, with that, we've been going for about an hour. Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history, and next time we'll start delving into your through hiking. What do you think?
I like it.
Awesome. We finally got there. Yay!
Right, I know. Just getting through my history is, I don't know that I've ever sat down and tried to do it, and it's a lot.
No, you've done well. I realize it's like, oh my gosh, there's a lot of stories that you didn't talk about, and someday when you want to, especially your time overseas and time in the service, someday. But till then, let's conclude part two of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Jen Hogan. Today is July 10th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Jen, thank you so very much.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.